Hello and welcome. You are listening to the Civitas On Air podcast, where we bring to you informed debate and discussion. This podcast is part of an EU-funded Jean Monnet module, DEBU, Debating Europe, Internal and External Dynamics of European Integration at Collegium Civitas.
Hi everyone, welcome to our podcast. The topic of the EU enlargement has been on the headlines since the 2022 Russian invasion of Ukraine. Today I've got with me Professor Carrie Longhurst and Professor Vanessa Tinker, who will be talking about this novel context and the challenges faced by specific nations in their EU accession process. So over to you, Professor Longhurst.
Thanks. It is a really important topic to think about. The start of the war back in February 2022 really unleashed a whole new dynamic. Until then, for about 10 or 15 years, certainly since Croatia became a member in 2013, there was a real sense of fatigue, a real slowdown. The countries in the Western Balkans, like Montenegro and North Macedonia and Albania, you know, they'd been in line to become members for really quite a long time, yet the progress was very slow. It was characterised by a very slow and unwieldy process. As we all said already, that when Russia invaded Ukraine, this was like a bolt out of the blue in many ways, and it started a whole new dynamic. But the situation right now, we have Ukraine and Moldova, who were on the cusp, on the very beginning of starting their actual accession negotiations. So we've got to catch up in our thinking about this subject.
And although there has been quite a bit already written on EU enlargement, considering what Carrie just talked about, no one has really yet talked about and drawn to attention the novelty of this particular EU enlargement. And so we are actually right now researching two countries, candidate countries in particular. We're looking at Moldova and Bosnia-Herzegovina, just to kind of really draw to attention what are these obstacles and challenges. And we're hoping that it can kind of just add insight in terms of what are the EU options, you know, because they're unlike former EU accession processes. This one in particular will be very challenging, just given the distance that these countries have compared to former countries that gained EU membership.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, just to kind of reinforce what you were saying, 2004 was the biggest kind of post-Cold War enlargement. And at that point, countries like Poland and Hungary, Latvia, Lithuania, of course, they were different in terms of their governance and their economies to the European Union as it was back then. But arguably, when we look at Moldova and Bosnia, Ukraine, et cetera, the distances in terms of their governance, their stability of their democracy, the condition of the rule of law is so much bigger, is so much wider and so different to the European Union standards. And this is why, indeed, it is a very novel concept, a novel situation, which has consequences for the countries themselves and huge consequences for the European Union as well. But there are other novelty factors as well, Vanessa.
Yeah, I mean, just the methodology as well, even though it's not entirely new, it hasn't really had a chance to be put into practice. And so prior to this current EU accession, the methodology that they used was more based on particular list approach, and now it's based on clusters. And so what we talk about in our current research is this main primary cluster, the fundamentals cluster, and we really focus in on it because it's actually the first to open and the last to close because it's so challenging. It looks specifically at the institutions. It looks specifically at fundamental freedoms. It talks about also just the human rights. There's a lot of various factors, but in particular, these countries that are current candidates, they face several obstacles, not only the distance that we just discussed, but also given the fact, and that's what we're looking at, Bosnia and Moldova, they have frozen conflicts, extreme polarization, where you have Bosnia-Herzegovina, for example, trying to, within the country, have breakaway. So we really just are talking about how does the EU intend to address these challenges. So there's this, on the one hand, this need for speed, but on the other, you know, you don't want to sidestep these really essential critical factors.
Thank you so much for that, Professor. So despite the fact that there are too many complexities and too many challenges involved, still we're getting the news like for granting the starting the accession talks and getting the new candidate status to Georgia, for example. And as I've already mentioned, in the case of Bosnia, and it was the amber light, so-called, given not to start the accession process as of yet. And also the recent decision to, not a decision, but actually an announcement by Charles Michel, and to urge to facilitate the EU accession process and to make it the so-called complete by 2030. We're still witnessing that. But concerning the point that you've mentioned about this switch to the so-called clustered approach, my first question to you, and you've probably covered that in your research, is that don't you think that by focusing on the cluster of certain things rather than, let's say, adopting this, having this point-by-point approach, we're undermining the developments in some specific areas that are not included in a specific cluster, let's say in the case of Bosnia?
It's a really important part because the change in EU accession methodology is indeed another part of the novel aspect of this particular enlargement. Probably, as you know, the previous rounds of enlargement, the methodology of a country joining was based upon negotiations on a step-by-step, chapter-by-chapter approach. And this worked really well in the past. It was changed already in 2020, so before the start of the war. And indeed, as you described it, this clustered approach where 2, 3, 4, or 5 chapters are negotiated kind of together in a more amalgamated or combined fashion, i.e. a cluster, does have consequences. As Vanessa said, the fundamentals cluster to do with rule of law and democracy and governance is the first one to open and it's the last one to close. And that means that a country can negotiate very well in lots of other areas, the economy, border controls, transport, health and safety. But ultimately, unless they complete everything in the fundamentals cluster, it's going to be, you know, a stop. It's going to be a halt. It's going to be no progress, basically. But another point is there, and it's reflecting on what Vanessa just said, that within the cluster of these 4 or 5 different areas, it could be that the European Union will let countries join even though they haven't fulfilled all of the areas. And that can be good and bad, however you know, whichever way you look at the subject. It could mean a speedier enlargement, which is very interesting for some stakeholders, but it could also be a way of blocking it. You know, you've done everything else really well, but until you show yourself in terms of rule of law and governance, you've got to wait until you sort yourself out, basically. So just to kind of reiterate what I said, the change in methodology is another really unique feature of this enlargement compared to previous ones.
Vanessa, would you like to comment on that?
I mean, I think even though we have this timeline that people within the EU have been discussing, this 2030, whether or not it's realistic, these countries, especially I would say Bosnia-Herzegovina, will be able to tackle some of these fundamental areas. I think it's a bit optimistic, but at the same time, I think that these countries need to have some timeline or something substantial that they can actually work towards. Because when you just leave it, you know, once you satisfy each of these areas, then we can proceed. But if you don't have any kind of concrete, tangible timelines, I think that it's dangerous. And I think this is where you could see this backsliding happening, especially with those who have been in this process for a significant amount of time. I mean, if you look at the case of Serbia, Montenegro, North Macedonia, you can see this frustration and this tendency to backslide and even drift. And I think there's this fear that if we don't speed up this process and if we don't, it's not per se, I would say, turning a blind eye, but maybe some of these areas that they can work around or work with, that is maybe still worth it, because the alternative, I think, is still quite dangerous in their eyes.
Yeah, I think what the EU is trying to do is weigh up the pros and cons. Mm-hmm. Obviously, letting countries in too soon has huge dangers for the integrity of the union, for the development of the countries as well. Because if you let a country in with very weak rule of law or, you know, democratic faults, they're importing those problems into the EU, which are very hard to tackle once a country is inside. And it could mean as well that you're, you know, weakening civil society in these countries, which is far from ideal as well. But at the same time, there is this, as you said, Vanessa, you know, a need for speed. Mm-hmm. The geopolitics, the ongoing war in Russia, the threat of further Russian irredentism in countries like Moldova and Georgia and perhaps elsewhere has just brought a whole new sense of geopolitical urgency to European integration, which was definitely not there before. And we've got to take note of that, because if we don't speed up, maybe the risks are bigger and more consequential than letting the countries in a kind of half-baked way.
You've correctly pointed out on the issue of Russian irredentism, and that's exactly what we're seeing in the headline, that the enlargement is going to threaten the integrity of the European Union as an institution and the integrity of the individual member states as well. And from what I'm seeing, there are four key points that are mostly mentioned in those so-called narratives that are skeptical to the enlargement. Those are corruption, oligarchy, and weak institutions. So maybe if you could comment on each of those specific issues that you've covered in your research and provide your, let's say, academic forecast on how the situation is going to develop and what the European Union can do to address those specific pain points, let's say.
I mean, certainly in the cases of Moldova and Bosnia, there's so much to say about all of these issues, state capture, oligarchy, corruption, which of course are also interconnected. In both countries, all of these problems have been persistent over the last 20 or 30 years, and obviously their legacies of the end of the Soviet Union in the case of Moldova. So I'll look at Moldova in particular before passing over to Vanessa. Since around 2019, when two of Moldova's main oligarchs, let's say the grand oligarchs of Moldova, left the country and now they're fugitives, there has been, I think, a fresh chance for the country to get rid of its state capture, to tackle corruption and to peel away all of those problems it had for the last 10, 20 years or so. But it's not a far from a clean slate. You know, the government has created under a new pro-European, pro-reform leadership, which is fairly stable, I would say. They have started to create better anti-corruption institutions and bodies to implement and to enforce EU-style laws in anti-corruption. They've established a de-oligarchization law, which is currently being implemented, and that's in line with the Venice Commission. So in a way, I think in Moldova, all of the building blocks or the fundamental stones to tackle and to end oligarchy and state capture are definitely in place, but they're going to take months, if not years, to actually have an effect. And crucially, the oligarchs who escaped the country over the last 2 or 3 years or so, they haven't been brought to justice. You know, so you've got the big picture of a lack of change, and meanwhile, small cases of corruption are being tackled, which is not very satisfactory for citizens because they see, you know, the big rich people getting away with things still. So, you know, there's progress, I would say, and Moldova's improving, but nevertheless, there's lots of gaps and holes, which presents problems for their EU integration and for public trust in the government's goals as well.
I think in the case of Bosnia, it's slightly different. I mean, it's similar but different. I mean, they don't have, per se, this problem with oligarchs the way that Moldova does. But corruption obviously does remain problematic. I would even argue what's even more is the current constitutional arrangement, the ethnic divisions, which basically feeds into this problem of weak institutions. I mean, at every single level, it's reproducing itself. It's not efficient. There's no cross-party cooperation, let alone cross-ethnic cooperation. And all the more, I think it's dangerous, is this extreme polarization. And that's one thing we really draw attention to in our research, is how does the EU envision dealing with these issues? I don't feel there's been a huge discussion. I feel that they're hoping, perhaps, that once these countries eventually join, it'll become less problematic. I mean, if you take the case of Northern Ireland, in many ways, I would argue it did help. But in the case of Bosnia-Herzegovina, it's extreme to the point where the constitutional arrangement as it stands, it basically remains stagnant in terms of its efficiency. And I really don't see how they're going to work around it unless there is constitutional reform. And I mean, you know, I wouldn't say that's quite the extreme case in Moldova. But, you know, when you have, for example, Republika Srpska, the leadership basically almost on a daily basis threatening to secede, that is really dangerous. And it just calls into question, you know, the territorial integrity of the state, and I don't really know the complete strategy of how the EU intends to handle it. And I go back to, I think there's this hope that these problems will become less problematic once they're in.
But I think the theme of polarization is really critical. And I absolutely agree. It's much more kind of multi-level, let's say, in Bosnia and very much present in Moldova as well. And, you know, if we look at the EU's reporting on these countries' progress tracks towards European integration, it tends to overlook how fundamental this polarization is on all the different levels, you know, it occurs. This is like the basics of state integrity, as you said, physically, but also state building and its capacity to like function in terms of policy, public policy and diplomacy, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, as our work goes on this subject, polarization is definitely has to be a focal point because it is so critical for this EU integration process.
I would actually just to further add to that, I mean, going back to the case of Bosnia, I mean, when you have a portion of the country that's denying that genocide ever took place, I mean, that's huge. That's problematic. I mean, if you're not properly addressing the past, all of these things you can't just sweep under the carpet. These are like core areas that need to be addressed. Otherwise, I just feel that, you know, when you have countries like this that are extremely polarized, that are not able to cooperate together, that will create huge problems for the EU.
Yeah, lack of consensus as well is a symptom of that. And again, it's what makes this enlargement, the one that's, you know, emerging right now, different to previous enlargements. Again, comparing Bosnia or Moldova with Poland and the other countries that joined in 2004, there was a strong consensus in those countries, cross-party consensus, public opinion, all very pro-EU and wanting integration. You've described very well how it is in Bosnia. There is just isn't that level of anything close to a consensus. In Moldova, it's a bit better, but nevertheless, there are these dyads of difference politically, you know, identity-wise as well. And without that kind of commonness, that national goal, I think, in view, I think it's very, very difficult for a country to really implement in a sustainable way all of the policies they have to do to get closer to the EU.
I think also the question that the EU needs to ask itself, and I'm sure they have been asking themselves, is how willing are they to play this key role in helping to assist in state building? Because effectively, that's what they're going to be doing. Because it is going to be a real hands-on, I would say, process to help these countries. I mean, again, going back to this, you know, idea and this theme of distance, there's tremendous differences between former countries that joined the EU and the current candidates. And again, this will require then within the EU a willingness to take on this greater role than it has in the past.
Yeah, I think this will be like a test of one of the skills that the EU, you know, prides itself on, this state building, this kind of bottom-up approach, bringing in civil society, creating democratic institutions, installing the rule of law. I mean, this is the kind of the EU's set piece. It's what it's supposed to do very well. It's got some experience, but the tasks ahead in this area are, as you said, bigger than before, and it's going to require this hands-on approach. Completely, I agree.
Yeah, but let me ask you both this question. Don't you think that the European Union is going to basically shoot itself in the foot by imposing the, let's say, as Bosnians may perceive them, as so-called state-building measures? And in Republika Srpska, there will very likely be an extremely strong opposition towards an increased involvement of the European Union into the reformulation of the state institutions across the entire federation. So don't you think that this will actually undermine those nation's ability to comply with the accession criteria?
I mean, I would go into the case of Bosnia. I think it's a balancing act because, yes, you're right. I mean, there's been a clear kind of resistance from Republika Srpska saying, you know, we don't want foreigners involved in our decision-making processes. They made it very clear. But on the other hand, I think the EU is saying, okay, right, well, then we're not going to give you further funds, development funds, you know, because it has to be a give and take. It's not just we receive and then that's it. So, and I think the EU's made that clear. They're not going to just sidestep the merit base. You know, while there is this need for speed, at the same time, they're not willing to sacrifice kind of these fundamental areas. But it is, I think, a balancing act. It's kind of, I think, a, you know, move forward and then take a step back. And it's a constant, you know, I would say negotiation.
And I think when it comes to Moldova, again, there are similarities but differences as well. I think for the EU to succeed in Moldova, there has to be a time frame, I think, is very important. You know, Moldova has wanted to become a member for a long time, but the EU kept it at arm's length until 2022, when things really sped up. The government and civil society in Moldova has made huge efforts in reforming and kind of obeying and meeting the EU's wishes. And from the EU side, if it doesn't want to have this foot shooting episode, you know, it's going to have to give concessions to Moldova and have maybe a kind of staged approach to membership, because if the EU doesn't have that generosity in its strategy towards Moldova, it's going to lose big parts of Moldovan society. You know, asking Moldovan farmers to reform, which are costly, and you know, changing their modes of operation. If the EU doesn't open its markets even more, if it doesn't enable citizens to benefit from EU membership sooner rather than later, yeah, it's going to lose the support at the national level in Moldova.
Thank you. Yeah, you've correctly pointed out the potential benefits that the currently opposing actors can get, both in Moldova and in Bosnia, from their countries joining the European Union. But still, taking the, let's say, the metaphorical nature of the so-called ethnic question aside, we still do have some things that we need to consider when it comes to the actual measures and the actual potential for securitization of minorities, ethnic minorities. For example, when it comes to Moldova, you've correctly raised this question that there is a huge level of polarization in society, which is also evident in the country's ethnic division. And the fact that while Bosnia, for example, there is a threat of secession, Moldova has actually already experienced secession back in the 1990s. While the conflict is frozen, still there is the similarity between the two countries. But the fact that in Moldova, the residents of Transnistria, most of them have several passports, so they are Moldovan citizens, that they have also the Transnistrian passports that are not recognized, and many of them also have Russian passports. So considering that they're also like aligned ideologically, like against the values of the European Union, and some of them are aligned with Russia, what do you think, like what's the potential for this situation to develop in a negative way in the future?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, my kind of overall response to that is that, of course, there is this identity-related divide in Moldova. But if you go there, if you talk with people, you see that most people living in Chisinau or the other big cities, you know, they're quite comfortable, actually, with Russian-speaking, Romanian-speaking. That the depth of that identity-related division, I don't think is quite as deep or unbridgeable as perhaps we're actually led to believe. You're right, with the breakaway area or Republic of Transnistria, which is really a de facto state, it's more than just a breakaway area. Of course, this poses problems for Moldova's European integration. But having said that, there's a lot of pragmatism out there. As you mentioned, Transnistrians have multiple passports. They're not that wedded to their Russian identity. They're pragmatic. They cross the borders all the time. They have property, they have, you know, they can access the EU's visa-free regime, they can profit from the EU deep and comprehensive free trade agreement. So it's not such a divide as perhaps people might think. The EU's thinking is that we're not going to resolve the conflict. We can't wait for that to happen before we start bringing Moldova into the European Union. What we need to do is proceed with accession, show Moldova the benefits, bring about prosperity, stability, et cetera, you know, a more resilient state. And then over time, the Transnistrian leaders, they'll see, hey, this is a good deal. What on earth are we holding ourselves back for from this? Let's participate. And that means the start of a maybe slow but steady reintegration process that could happen between Transnistria and Moldova. Having said that, of course, you've got the potential for a Russian threat. I don't think at the moment a potential for a real invasion launched from Transnistria, but there's always the potential for Russian destabilization, fake news, influencing, try to kind of shake up and break up the process of European integration, whether it's through the media or what have you. But that's a fact and we know it, but we can't, I don't think, let that determine our behavior with regards to Moldova's integration.
Thank you. So, yeah, as you mentioned correctly, this is going to be a process based on political bargaining and a bargaining of benefits, and eventually the outcome, I guess, in my opinion at least, would be determined by whoever benefits the most and what kind of actor would actually dominate the area, dominate the ideological landscape and political landscape. But when it comes to Bosnia, for example, my question to you, Vanessa, is that while there is the threat of secessionism is still the so-called, let's say, imaginary, still there is a potential for escalation and clashes, because there are like some notions that state that the fulfillment of the rule of law and the supremacy of the rule of law mechanisms in the country depends on your ethnicity. So we're seeing a huge potential for protests and, again, for securitization by external actors. What do you think, in your opinion, the union can do to mitigate the situation in a way?
I mean, I think that's why the constitutional reform constantly comes up. I mean, given the fact that we have the so-called bond powers, you know, you have an EU representative that's basically overseeing the decision-making of a country, basically of a foreigner inserted into the country that's influencing how decisions are made, the OHR. That already, even the EU acknowledges, is not healthy for a democracy development. Basically, it hinders because there's this dependency on this, you know, external foreign element in their system. So I think really what needs to happen is, like, which already has happened, but there is this resistance. I think the country's in this kind of catch-22 where there's this fear of, if you were to have a constitutional reform, what are the consequences? On the other hand, there's this realization, if they don't have constitutional reform, the likelihood that they're going to get the green light to continue with accession into the EU is probably not going to happen. I mean, even this deadline in March, realistically, I don't foresee how they're going to tackle these key areas that the EU has already said, until they are addressed, until they see any progress, that window of opportunity is going to close. And I think that's a really dangerous area to even consider, because if, in fact, the EU shuts the door to Bosnia-Herzegovina, I think that the country could definitely go in the wrong direction.
Yeah, definitely. I think everyone recognizes the outdated nature of all the mechanisms and institutions that were established right after the war and the breakup of Yugoslavia. So definitely there is a huge potential for reform. But when it comes to, let's say, the constitutional norms, the rule of law, and electoral participation in both of the countries, my question to you, Carrie, would you consider the recent news about some of the political parties in Moldova being effectively banned from running electoral campaigns and participating in elections because of the alleged Russian affiliation? Would you consider that as a violation of political representation, the freedom of speech, and the supremacy of the rule of law in general, and extreme, let's say, more extreme polarization in the country?
Oh, for sure. Freedom of association, freedom of assembly, etc., etc. When these are being challenged, they're always a cause for concern. I mean, we should always, you know, hold these freedoms and these rights, hold them up as sacrosanct, as very important. So when they are challenged by a party in government, we should always be concerned. However, in this particular case, when certain parties were excluded and banned from taking part in local elections in Moldova at the end of 2023, we have to see that in the context of the war. These parties, I would say, were not just alleged Moscow-friendly. They were, you know, clearly Moscow-friendly and peddling the kind of message from Moscow about Russia's right to have invaded Ukraine and what happened subsequently to that. So in this particular case, I think it was legal. I think it was constitutional, the government banning these particular parties who not just aligned with Moscow, but crucially run and controlled by the oligarchs who were fugitives living outside of the country. So I think there were plenty of legal reasons to ban them. Having said that, again, it's important to, you know, watch over governments and make sure they're not overextending their capacity or their mandate to deal with parties or individuals who are acting illegally.
Thank you. Yeah, it all goes back to the issue of corruption. And I think that in Bosnia, we can see a similar tendency. And surprisingly, even though there's still some connection between the country and the Russian Federation, I think that there is also a potential for securitization and even an increased scale of corruption with the, let's say, with the handle, with the involvement of the People's Republic of China. For example, there are upcoming and already existing projects within the Belt and Road initiatives in the region, in the Montenegro and in Bosnia and Herzegovina. We can also consider this from this perspective, and I think that it's an important issue to cover. So I think that my question to you would be, is there a potential for, let's say, a similar destabilization of the situation, an increased political polarization that would be motivated by the People's Republic of China and the Belt and Roads because of the benefits that are going to be received by actors in Bosnia? Let's say, I'm not sure if they have oligarchs, they probably do, but in general, let's say the language of benefits, this kind of a tactic by the People's Republic of China.
I mean, I wouldn't even necessarily bring China into the fact. I mean, there is corruption. I wouldn't even say in just Republic of Srpska. It's all over Bosnia-Herzegovina. I mean, given how the system works and the weakness of the institutions, the accountability of institutions, there's constantly reports of payoffs and what have you. But there is obviously this danger, you know, in terms of with Republic of Srpska's connections with Russia, as you already mentioned, and I would say by extension then China. And because of the cozy relationship with Republika Srpska and Serbia, yeah, I mean, I think like Serbia, Republika Srpska is also weighing its kind of what are their options? If not the EU, you know, if there's an attractive offer alternatively in terms of aligning itself more with Russia and by extension China, then yeah, I think there is this huge danger and also this further pull away from the EU.
Thank you, yeah. And also there is a notion that says that the economic distances between the current EU member states and the potential EU member states is pretty much greater than it was back during the previous waves of EU enlargement in 2004 and 2007. So again, what is the potential for some specific existing EU member states hampering the process because of the, let's say, specific lobbying or populist interest dominating the public landscape that will say something like, we don't want to provide funds, we don't want to provide subsidies to nations that are already impoverished and are probably not going to bring a significant benefit to the European Union. Like, for example, in the case of Moldova, which like the primary source of export for Moldova is, if I'm not mistaken, the consumer goods and food, which is not, let's say, as beneficial as it would have been the case with Ukraine, which is the major grain exporter. So how would you assess this situation?
Yeah, I mean, the economics of enlargement are obviously intertwined with those big political issues. And of course, it's already a discussion. You know, bringing in more members, even small ones like Moldova and potentially Bosnia, is going to change how things work institutionally. It's going to affect the budget. And already the EU is you know, thinking about adjusting the budget, adjusting the institutions to take account of more members joining maybe in the nearish future. Now, whether the methods of EU funding change or not, the fact is when new members join who are considerably poorer, it means that the resources shift from the existing states to the new states. And there are a couple of scenarios that have been discussed. One is more kind of frightening and severe, which was published by the Financial Times, which argued that very high levels of shifts of agricultural CAP funding and cohesion funds will be shifted towards the east and away from existing member states. Other scenarios say that well, actually the economic gains will be far bigger than if we don't allow new countries in. But nevertheless, yeah, the new member states are considerably poorer compared to the EU states, compared to those that joined in 2004. And that's inescapable. But again, we have to think about the short-term costs, the medium-term costs or gains, and the long-term gains of enlarging. But this discussion, as you suggested, is far from over. And when it comes to enlargement, it's not just about the new member states adjusting, it's about the existing member states adjusting as well. And I'm not quite sure how willing they are to do that.
Yeah. Vanessa, would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, just going to what Carrie was saying with the shift of funding, I mean, I think with even the discussions they're having in the EU, you can almost kind of identify these blocks forming within the EU, you know, like the south and the north, the west and the east. So by taking on new members with huge discrepancies in terms of their development institutionally, economically, what have you, I think that it could create a further strain within the EU. I think there could be some resistance actually within EU member states who have up until now been heavily kind of reliant on the support to kind of help them catch up with Western EU members. So I think it's going to be crucial to have more dialogue and conversation about this. And again, not just to sidestep and rush this, because these are critical points that need to be discussed, because it can create even more chaos within the EU.
And I think as well, I mean, you know, luckily the EU has enlarged before many times. And so there is that expertise and that knowledge in EU institutions about how to deal with the economic differences, the discrepancies. I mean, that's always been the case. Even when, you know, Spain Portugal and Greece, rather, joined, you know, they were considerably poorer. And yet through the transfer of funds, you know, we know what to do. We know what the economic script is. But it is those other discrepancies and distances to do with governance and corruption, rule of law. These are really harder to tackle. And these are the issues that have to really be confronted and thought about. But I think as well, as I think as you kind of hinted at, there needs to be this discussion. We need to think about short-term economic costs versus long-term political stability. And I think also what's still missing really from, certainly from the academic discussion here, is the kind of morality of all this. You know, there's the fact of, you know, don't we have an ethical responsibility to have more of an open door approach to countries like Bosnia and Moldova, if they so wish, to join, not to, you know, mention Ukraine and Georgia as well. They've been excluded from this European dynamic. They've been far from self-excluded, and it's been external powers. So I think we have to bring that into centre stage as well, because this is where the EU has thrived in the past. You know, 2004 enlargement arguably would not have happened if we didn't think in those moral and ethical terms.
I think at the same time, though, the EU is becoming more pragmatic in its approach. And I think there is more of a discussion now about perhaps not having all in or all out, but rather a different types of speed approach, you know, looking at kind of alternatives, not just having one set standard model that everyone has to follow, but because there's different paces in which the countries are tackling some of these challenges, the EU, by supporting them in these different areas, and some will maybe go faster than others. Some might have some setbacks given their situations internally. So I think there is this kind of this pragmatic approach that the EU is now kind of rethinking, even though they've changed their methodology, how to further kind of refine it and make it more relevant to these current candidate countries.
That's right. I mean, for decades, actually, a lot of EU leaders and academics have been talking about multi-speed Europe, concentric circles. And I think, you know, now when we look forward to the, or, you know, whether it's with fear or with anticipation or excitement, when we look at the next enlargement, I think there's never been a moment when this idea of a multi-speed Europe has been more appropriate in terms of the right way to go, to bring in countries, not to close the door, but to recognise that there are big differences and big challenges ahead. So if we want to bring them into the EU's orbit, we're going to have to think in very different and creative ways as to how the EU of the future might look. And who knows, it might bring the UK back into the fold as well. But, you know, I think it's really interesting that even, you know, French leadership has been thinking about the EU in these terms. This is a revolution, I would say, in thinking. So it's definitely something to focus on.
You've raised several important points, and actually the stumbling points that are not only related to the nations that want to join the European Union, but the institutional framework of the European Union. And if we, let's say for a moment, just drop this focus on the clustered approach and focus on some other issues such as gender equality and climate change, for example, I think that there is also a huge potential for the development of another stumbling point that can potentially cause a shift in the EU's methodology and the EU's view of the enlargement. Like, for example, when it comes to climate change, those nations are most likely not extremely compliant with the regulations that the European Union has put for its existing members. So it is, in my opinion at least, quite likely that those requirements and the institutional frameworks in this realm are going to be adjusted, in my opinion. So I was wondering, what do you think about that? Like, issues not necessarily related to climate change, but the spheres that are not included in the so-called first fundamental cluster of the enlargement.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole host of areas, accession chapters, other clusters, as you mentioned. And speaking in terms of Moldova, there are many areas where actually Moldova has really moved very swiftly and very well towards the EU's acquis and EU norms in a whole load of areas, from transport to climate to environment to energy. I think people will be surprised actually how far Moldova has gone in lots of sectoral areas. Of course, there are gaps and holes, but being a small country which has a lot of donor support over many decades now, it's actually come up to, you know, a fairly high standard in lots of areas. And in terms of energy in particular, it was shortly after the start of the war that Moldova became even more aligned with EU energy physically when the grids were connected to help Moldova and Ukraine offset their previous dependence on Russia. So I think what the picture really shows is that the sectoral, the policy areas, that's relatively easy for Moldova to get up to speed. It's going back to the fundamentals, this cluster of the real tricky, nitty-gritty areas which are really problematic, and that's where all the hard work is going to have to focus on.
Vanessa?
And I think that it makes for interesting research that more could be done actually looking at what are the different alternatives and approaches that the EU can maybe possibly rethink, you know, in terms of this fundamental approach or the fundamental cluster, given that it is the most challenging area. So in what ways can the EU maybe possibly think about supporting these candidates to help them kind of tackle some of these fundamental areas? So I think there's a lot the EU is right now considering, and also just, I think, understanding that it has to really rethink its approach, becoming more flexible, thinking about these different speeds, but at the same time, being perhaps more realistic.
And I think one of the keys to that kind of approach about the realism, which is really, I think, completely, you know, essential now, is not to look at all these countries as a big block. There's so much divergence between them, you know, in terms of size, obviously, in terms of their level of development, their geopolitical realities, their identities, the role of Russia, the role of China. So I think it's important that, yeah, that kind of like block approach isn't taken, because that inevitably means the whole thing will be delayed. You know, give those good students, give those countries which are proceeding in a sustainable way, you know, let them thrive, let them flourish and get closer to the EU before the others, and be model pupils and let that prosperity spread.
Yeah, and going back to the topic of societal polarization and the general conservative and the opposition to the EU values, let's discuss, as a final point, let's discuss the issue of gender equality. For example, Vanessa, when it comes to Bosnia, it's still quite a conservative society, as we know. Like, nearly half of the Bosnian population are Muslims, hence why there could be some opposition to the values. So maybe if you could cover some of the existing and potential EU soft power initiatives that can contribute to the development of the situation in the country.
I mean, I think gender equality, they have made some improvements. I would say, though, in terms of like the LGBTQ+, there has been, though, some backsliding in the area in the Republika Srpska, and again, mirroring basically what Russia's done. So I think that the EU, in terms of just supporting kind of the progress the country has been making, is going to be critical. And, you know, I don't think it's just Bosnia-Herzegovina that struggles to tackle some of these gender equality issues, but to constantly develop ways in which they can support countries that, I think, it is on their agenda, they know it's important, but in terms of finding ways to kind of further help them along in this transition.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is also a really, really important topic. If we look around the world, you know, some of the most prosperous, stable countries with a heightened level of well-being are those with a high level of gender equality. And I think when it comes to EU enlargement, if the countries that want to join don't make further efforts or more serious efforts to improve gender equality on lots of different levels, the whole process of joining the EU is going to be based upon inequality and a lack of inclusion. And so I think it's far from a marginal issue. I think it has to be brought into centre stage. And whether we're talking about transport, Aki, whether we're talking about environment or climate or trade with regards to their readiness to join the EU, the gender aspect has to be covered in all of those areas. So don't see it as separate, but rather see it as important across the whole kind of range of accession negotiations. Moldova is a little bit different, I'd say, than Bosnia. Until recently, both the Prime Minister and the President were female, which obviously is a change to how it has been before. Maybe it's no coincidence that this duo of women have, you know, battled against the oligarchs and maybe led to some kind of improvements. And I'm not actually joking. I think that's part of it. But at the same time, you know, Maldives also has quite a large number of female MPs. But when you look at female Labour participation rates, it could be better in Maldives. So there's lots of work to do. But I think there's a positive trend. But in the context of enlargement, whether it's Bosnia, Moldova or Ukraine, that gender aspect really has to be at the forefront of our thinking and our planning.
Professor Longhurst, Professor Tinker, thank you so much for such a fruitful discussion.
Thank you, Arslan, for having this discussion with us.
Yeah, thank you for leading this. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I hope you enjoy listening to our podcast.
Thank you so much for listening to Civitas On Air. We cover current and important political and social topics. Our work is produced by researchers and students from Collegium Civitas, together with Radio Palace. Please subscribe to our podcast by visiting your favourite streaming service, like Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And do stay tuned for the next episode.